How's the mic? Can everybody hear? Last night, I for one, I was on the second row, and I had trouble hearing Gloria Cronin's talk. So does one have to speak directly into the mic in order for it to be loud enough? Okay. Just directly? I don't have trouble with that. Okay. This session isn't... Nadine Hansen will be delivering a paper on Why Mormon Women Need Priesthood, the Case for Ordination. Nadine is an attorney in private practice in Cupertino, California. She also coordinates the efforts of the Peninsula South Bay chapter of the Mormon Women's Forum. She asked me to indicate to you that flyers and information on the South Bay... Whoops. There we go. Flyers will be available in the book room if you're interested in attending meetings, chapter meetings. They'll be in the book room next to the, with the Mormon Women's Forum subscription forms, which you're also welcome to fill out and give us money for the Mormon Women's Forum newsletter. Following Nadine's comments, paper, Janet Targin will be responding. Janet is a professor of mathematics at Bakersfield College, and she's also a Sunstone correspondent. So we'll go directly from the paper to the comments, and then if there's time afterward, we'll entertain questions from the floor. Nadine?
At the outset of this discussion on why women need the priesthood, I think, first of all, I need to explain what I mean by priesthood or how I will be discussing it in this paper. About 20 years ago, I thought that the definition of priesthood was very easy. Priesthood is the authority to act in the name of God. And although that's still a common definition and the definition that's given to investigators and new converts, it doesn't really describe or fully define what priesthood is. Boyd K. Packer recently said that priesthood is the authority and the power which God has granted men on earth to act for him. But some other church leaders have indicated that priesthood and authority are sometimes two different things. And Dallin Oaks, in a recent Ensign article, acknowledged that women have authority, but not priesthood. He quoted Joseph Fielding Smith as follows, "While the sisters have not been given the priesthood, that does not mean that the Lord has not given them authority. Authority and priesthood are two different things. A person may have authority given to him, or a sister to her, to do certain things in the church that are binding and absolutely necessary for salvation, such as the work our sisters do in the house of the Lord. Priesthood, thus, differs from authority since persons, presumably males, and sisters can have authority without having priesthood. We most often associate priesthood with healing the sick, giving blessings, and, of course, with performing church ordinances such as baptism, confirmation, and ordination. But these functions do not constitute priesthood, since women have historically performed either these identical functions or functions so similar as to render distinctions meaningless. Women have healed the sick and pronounced blessings upon the heads of others by the laying on of hands. In the area of church ordinances, women perform them in the temple. In fact, when it comes right down to it, about the only thing one can do with priesthood that he or she could not do simply with faith is to be admitted into the church's governing councils. Priesthood, then, as I will speak of it in this paper, is simply the right to rule, a right reserved exclusively for men. When the topic of women and priesthood arises, a variety of excuses against women's ordination are advanced. This paper discusses some of the most commonly articulated excuses, argues that they are nonsense, and concludes that exclusion of women from priesthood is detrimental both to women's spirituality and to the vitality and well-being of the church. The excuses I will discuss are the women are inferior excuse, the women are superior excuse, the Mormonism's odd couple motherhood priesthood excuse, the men are beasts who need taming excuse, and the we don't want to be co-opted excuse, the latter being the excuse most commonly advanced by liberals, intellectuals, and feminists. First of all, the women are inferior excuse. The notion that women are inferior is plainly out of favor today as a stated excuse for denying priesthood to women. In fact, it is so politically incorrect that I considered leaving it out. I'm including it, however, because I think that the belief in women's inferiority is still pervasive and is reinforced by exclusion from priesthood. Brigham Young once told the women, "Respect the power of priesthood while it is upon your husbands. Women have not the degree of light and knowledge that their husbands have, and they have not power over their passions." Few, if any, church leaders today would express such blatant disparagement of women. But the shortage of overt expressions of women's inferiority does not prevent the message of women's inferiority from coming through loud and clear. At the women's annual meeting in September of 1991, Elder Gordon B. Hinckley read and responded to a letter from a 14-year-old girl whom he called Virginia. Virginia had written to President Benson asking whether women could go to the celestial kingdom. She had searched the scriptures in vain for a reference to women entering the celestial kingdom and had observed that in his visions, Joseph Smith had seen only men there. Moreover, she queried, why, if we are all God's children, do the scriptures say that men are to rule over women? And why was Eve created from Adam? Are men more important than women? Elder Hinckley tried to reassure Virginia that women are not inferior to men. But the fact that Virginia raised the question and that Elder Hinckley felt a need to answer it is powerful evidence of the message that our church is sending to women and girls. Elder Hinckley recognized this problem, acknowledging with extraordinary understatement that perhaps Virginia's questions were on the minds of many women of all ages in the church. Virginia obviously had gotten this unspoken message. How pervasive is it? Just ask yourself, what 14-year-old Mormon boy would ever dream of asking whether men are as important as women? Men's high status in the church is obvious and pervasive and is perpetuated at women's expense, for there can be no privileged ruling class without a corresponding underprivileged ruled class. Equally important in reinforcing the notion of women's inferiority is our patriarchal view of the heavens, which perpetuates the idea that women's subordination to men is not limited to mortality, but continues on forever. This year's Relief Society study guide quotes an address to women by Elder Hinckley in which he urges each woman to, quote, be faithful to the great divine attributes that are within her, close quote. Yet the only model of divinity we are given is a male model, that of Heavenly Father. Women who have reached out for a feminine divine role model by including Mother in Heaven in their prayers have met with reproof. Such efforts to stifle the rising interest in Mother in Heaven surely reinforces the idea that since God is male, males are more like God than are females. Today, even the strongest opponents of women's ordination know they cannot expressly cite women's inferiority as a reason for excluding women from priesthood. But I believe that a lingering belief in women's eternal subordination to men both reinforces and is reinforced by denial of priesthood to women. Despite all the rhetoric about women's divine nature and incomparable place in God's plan, women will never be treated as equals of men as long as entry into the church's ruling priesthood class is determined by gender. The women are superior excuse. The women are superior excuse is among the most common excuses used to justify denial of priesthood to women. One of its most ardent champions, Boyd K. Packer, put it this way. The limitation of priesthood responsibilities to men is a tribute to the incomparable place of women in the plan of salvation. Men and women have complementary, not competing responsibilities. There's difference but not inequality. Intelligence and talent favor both of them. But in the woman's part, she is not just equal to man, she is superior. She can do that which he can never do, not in all eternity can he do it. Probably the most frightening specter of women's presumed superiority was propounded by Hartman Rector Jr. in a now well-publicized letter to a supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment. In order to attempt to get the male somewhere near even, the Heavenly Father gave him the priesthood or directing authority for the church and home. Without this bequeath, the male would be so far below the female in power and influence that there would be little or no purpose for his existence, and he, in fact, would probably be eaten by the female, as is the case with the Black Widow spider. These two statements about Hartman Rector Jr. I have to say, though, that he can't, being the man who produced Daniel Rector, he can't be all bad. These two statements about women's superiority reveal fear of women's power, fear that is manifested as a need to keep women under men's control, lest the tables be turned and women rule over men as men have ruled over women. Elder Packer's fear of competition from women is a curious excuse for denying women priesthood. If men and women both had priesthood, would women compete with men? Do two male leaders, male priesthood holders compete? Why, if men don't compete in priesthood matters, does he think ordained women will pose a competitive threat to men? The women are superior excuse, far from affirming women's superiority, is a device used to keep women in their subordinate place. Mormon rhetoric abounds with references to women's divinely ordained role and high and holy calling, but such rhetoric is patronizing and artificial. If women in Mormon society are so superior, why is depression so much greater a problem for Mormon women than for Mormon men? Why do 14-year-old girls write to the church president asking if men are more important than women? Why do church leaders feel the need to constantly reassure us that women are men's equals? Why do men need no corresponding reassurance that they are the equals of women? Many feminists would identify the women are superior excuse as a classic example of a patriarchal reversal. A patriarchal reversal occurs when someone states the opposite of the true fact in order to strengthen and justify male dominance. The women are superior excuse does just that. It misstates women's true subordinate status in the church and home in order to justify the divine right of males to remain in charge. Consider for illustration an example of a patriarchal reversal from outside our culture. After Islamic fundamentalists in Tehran took over the American embassy and seized its employees as hostages, it shortly thereafter released the women. A spokesman for the group explained that it released the women because, quote, Islam holds women in high regard, close quote. This statement is an Islamic patriarchal reversal not so far removed from our own. The difference is one of degree, not of kind. Women are not superior to men, at least in not any way that matters in terms of women's or men's ability to be priesthood holders and to serve in all positions of church governance. When women do that on an equal basis with men, questions of inferiority and superiority will quickly vanish and we will wonder why anyone ever raised them. The Mormonism's odd couple excuse. Perhaps the most commonly asserted excuse for denying priesthood to women is the excuse that men have priesthood because women have motherhood. Sonia Farnsworth has labeled this mismatch Mormonism's odd couple. Farnsworth explains, "Today, women have motherhood and men have priesthood, or so the saying goes. In spite of this, LDS women are taught that women share the priesthood with their husbands. The 1991 Relief Society Study Guide explains that this shared factor by defining motherhood as an eternal part of priesthood. In other words, priesthood can be shared with women just as long as all the priesthood part is reserved for men." End of quote. Farnsworth traces the motherhood-priesthood excuse back to a 1954 revision of John A. Widsoe's book, Priesthood and Church Government, which said, quote, "The man who feels he is better than his wife because he holds the priesthood has failed to comprehend the meaning of priesthood. Woman has her gift of equal magnitude, motherhood. Motherhood is an eternal part of priesthood. It should be obvious to anyone..." That was end of quote. It should be obvious to anyone willing to think about this excuse that it is contrived and illogical. In fact, the illogic of it is so thoroughgoing that I find it difficult to understand why so many people seem to find it compelling. What's wrong with it? For starters, fatherhood, not priesthood, is the male role that corresponds to motherhood. Women presently have no role corresponding to priesthood. Church leaders seem to have no difficulty envisioning the essential harmony between priesthood and fatherhood, but apparently can't conceive, no pun intended, of how women could of how women could be mothers and also be priesthood bearers. If women had priesthood, would they cease to be mothers? Do men cease to be fathers because they have priesthood? Priesthood is conferred upon all worthy men, irrespective of whether they are fathers. Women, by contrast, are not all mothers, even if they want to be. And even the most dedicated mothers don't spend all of their time or all of their lives mothering. If motherhood is what prevents women from having priesthood, then women who are not mothers should have no bar to ordination. Furthermore, if motherhood means that the demands of nurturing and rearing children are such that priesthood would get in the way of such important duties, then no man who is a single parent should have priesthood. Of course, no one ever suggests that men who are single parents cannot simultaneously manage their roles as parents and priesthood bearers, but that anomaly does not stop the frequent repetition of this wholly specious and contrived excuse. Time demands are obviously not the problem. Many women's callings, Relief Society president, young women's president, primary president, for example, are every bit as demanding and time-consuming as many priesthood callings. In the motherhood-priesthood rhetoric lies an underlying assumption that because mothers alone have the power to create life, they are ever so much more powerful than men, and that men need priesthood to compensate. a notion closely connected to the women are superior excuse. This is nonsense. Women don't conceive by parthenogenesis. It takes a father as well as a mother to create life. Once children are born, fathers can and should nurture and rear them, and being possessed of priesthood should enhance a mother's ability to be a good mother, just as it is presumed to enhance a man's ability to be a good father. The motherhood priesthood odd couple excuse is a sop thrown to women to placate them while maintaining and justifying the male divine right to rule. It is yet another patriarchal reversal. It is silly and illogical and deserves to be banished permanently from our lexicon of excuses. The men are beasts who need taming excuse is, in some ways, a variation on several of the preceding themes. This excuse posits the idea that women are naturally better suited to civilization than men, and that men need heavy doses of socialization to become good, productive members of society. One way to socialize them into making commitments to families and religion is by giving them the right to be in charge. In other words, by giving them the priesthood. This excuse was given expression at last summer's Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium in a paper presented by John Conkling. Conkling cited various anti-feminist writers who in recent years have given us the grim statistics about men. Men commit 88% of the murders, 87% of the aggravated assaults, 92% of the robberies, 89% of all the violent crimes. Men are more aggressive in virtually all societies, aggression being a biologically determined male trait. In matters of sexuality, men are by nature polygamous, seeking sexual frequency and variety, as shown by the following statistics. Quote, in a survey of homosexuals in San Francisco, 28% of males reported having had more than 1,000 partners, and 75% said they had had more than 100 partners. Not one lesbian reported having had 1,000 partners, and only 2% said they had more than 100. 50% of the lesbians have had only one partner, fewer partners than heterosexual women, close quote. And this, again, was quoted in John Conkling's paper. Thus, men, free to give full rein to their sexuality, unconstrained by the demands for commitment and monogamy imposed upon them by women, would run wildly amok sexually. Women, by contrast, freed from the pressures of male sexuality, would remain monogamous and committed to their solitary, or at least one-at-a-time, relationships. It is tempting to trivialize this notion of men as beasts who, without priesthood, would squander their lives with riotous living. Since most of the non-Mormon and thus non-priesthood-holding men I know find their greatest rewards in their relationships with their families, especially with their children. The data underlying this theory deserves a serious response, however, since it is true that a relatively small segment of the male population, most often males who have failed to establish committed relationships with women and families, does indeed account for many of society's ills. But suggesting that priesthood would help society by helping such men begs the question of whether such men are ill-suited to society because they lack relationships with women, or whether they lack relationships with women because they are ill-suited to society. Most men, even without priesthood, settle into reasonably long-term relationships with women and children. The suggestion that men will stay interested in families and religion only if they have the right to rule is demeaning to the many, many fine men I know who sincerely love and cherish their faith and their families, and who will continue to be outstanding husbands and fathers and spiritual leaders and followers even after women are fully integrated into positions of church leadership. In his paper, Conkling appealed to simple pragmatism as the reason for maintaining an all-male priesthood. In order to subvert men's natural instincts of unrestrained sexuality, competitive dominance, and lust for pride and power, we need to trick them into giving up such natural pursuits in the interest of society and civilization by giving them, priesthood, the right to rule in the church and home. Conkling argued, quote, To say that priesthood is a trick or a device is not to say that it is not real. I believe that God, knowing our imperfections, resorts to devices, bribes, rewards, threats, tricks and treats, anything short of force, to get us to act more justly and tenderly toward each other. Close quote. If retaining an all-male priesthood were merely a benevolent trick that could and would solve society's or the church's problems without imposing detriment upon women, the men or beasts excuse might provide at least some reasonable rationale for the way we socialize men into roles needed to serve the greater good of society and church. But excluding women from priesthood is not benevolent. It harms women by perpetuating women's subordination to men. It harms men by teaching them that they have the right to dominate other human beings, and it harms the church by depriving it of women's contributions to the decision-making councils of the church, contributions that our obsessively hierarchical church desperately needs today. Much research suggests that far from needing any tricks or devices to get men to bond with women and families, men are merely acting in their own best interests by doing so. Today, far more men than women seem to be seeking long-term marital commitments. In her book, Backlash, Susan Faludi observed that, quote, single men far outnumbered women in dating services, matchmaking clubs, and the personals columns, all of which enjoyed explosive growth in the decade. In the mid-80s, video dating services were complaining of 3-to-1 male-to-female sex ratios in their membership, close quote. Faludi further observes that personal ads were similarly lopsided. Out of 1,200 ads surveyed in 1988, most were placed by 35-year-old heterosexual men seeking long-term relationships. The benefits to men of relationships with women are legion and well documented. Demographer Paul Glick states that, quote, being married is about twice as advantageous to men as to women in terms of continued survival, close quote. Sociologist Jesse Bernard put it this way, there are few findings more consistent, less equivocal, and more convincing than the sometimes spectacular and always impressive superiority on almost every index, demographic, psychological, or social, of married over never married men. Despite all the jokes about marriage in which men indulge and all the complaints they lodge against it, it is one of the greatest boons of their sex, close quote. All of the benefits to men of marriage belie the notion that men will flee from women and family responsibilities if they are no longer given permission to dominate, whether by means of priesthood or any other means. They reap far too many benefits from committed relationships with women to simply chuck them all in pursuit of a wilder, freer lifestyle. And what consequence has our male-dominated society wrought upon women? Faludi observes that, quote, when mental health researchers Gerald Klerman and Myrna Weissman reviewed all the depression literature on women and tested for factors ranging from genetics to PMS to birth control pills, they could find only two prime causes for female depression, low social status and marriage, close quote. Low social status and marriage, the very two roles church leaders devote so much of their energy into indoctrinating women into accepting. Viewed in light of this research, the trick of giving men the right to rule looks far more like a trick to keep women pacified in their place than a trick to get men to act more justly and tenderly toward others. Is it any wonder that depression is a serious problem among Mormon women? Has our all-male priesthood resulted in benevolence toward women? Give me a break. The "we don't want to be co-opted" excuse is a relative newcomer to the group. An excuse that could not have arisen at all until women began to think seriously about whether they could ever hope to have priesthood or would ever want to. It is an excuse sometimes advanced by feminists and intellectuals who claim that, yes, excluding women from priesthood is sexist and causes problems for women, but giving women priesthood won't really solve women's problems in the church. Rather, it will merely co-opt them into a male system to their ultimate detriment. What women really need, this excuse says, is their own separate sphere and distance from men so that they can develop their own spiritual gifts and talents and women's ways of doing things. The "we don't want to be co-opted" excuse strikes me as a luxury that only the church's feminist and intellectual elite can afford. At least some of those who express this view aren't much bothered by an all-male priesthood because they don't much care about priesthood anyway. No longer encumbered by the impediment of taking priesthood leaders seriously, they feel little or no oppression when our patriarchs presume to direct the lives of women in the church, from telling us what to wear, to explaining how we should feel about our domestic and subordinate roles in the home and church, to determining what spiritual gifts we are given institutional permission to have and use. In my view, the problem with this excuse is that it fails to comprehend the monumental difficulty of effecting change for the great majority of Mormon women within an institution that doesn't provide us with any institutional avenues for developing any kind of women's spirituality, if indeed there is such a thing. Our system effectively isolates women from one another by controlling the means of communication between women. It does this by prescribing what we shall talk about in Relief Society and by placing obstacles in the way of open dialogue among women within the church's institutionalized communication system. One obvious example of an obstacle to women's communication with one another was the abolition of the Relief Society magazine. For all its faults, the magazine was an avenue of communication among women, or at least a way for the general leadership of the Relief Society to communicate directly with all women in the church. While it hardly had any feminist leanings during my lifetime, it did in the past. And I can't help but wonder what it would have been like today under the direction of a relatively progressive General Relief Society presidency if it had remained the independent publication that it once was. Today, all institutional communications among women in the church go through priesthood, read that, male channels. A small number of Mormon women communicate through independent publications and symposia, but what we do and say in forums like this one does not reach the membership of the church at large. In a nutshell, there's almost nothing average Mormon women can do today within the confines of the church's institutional constraints to explore and define the course that women's spirituality could take apart from the course that our all-male hierarchy prescribes for us. The obstacles to change are too great for women to effect any meaningful modifications in women's position in the church, absent entry into the church's decision-making councils through priesthood ordination. In some ways, I sympathize with those who want no part of a hierarchy that they may feel is irredeemably oppressive, but I also think they are unnecessarily pessimistic about the ability of women to effect constructive change once we have the power to do so. So while I understand the position of those who do not want to become a part of our hierarchy, I simply think that as a practical matter, we will not be able to make the church a significantly better place for women unless and until women fill all church leadership positions on an equal basis with men. Why women need the priesthood. Having examined some of the common excuses for denying priesthood to women and found them wanting, let's get to the heart of the matter of why women need the priesthood. It all really boils down to a question of who will have the power to make decisions about women's lives. The evidence of why women need the priesthood is most obviously portrayed in the sorry history of the church's steady and systematic suppression of women's spiritual power. During the past 10 to 15 years, historians have chronicled the steady decline of women's power in the church. Surely by now we all know, or should know, that women once healed the sick by the laying on of hands, pronounced prophetic blessings on each other and their children, sometimes spoken in the tongues of angels. They ran their own organization, the Relief Society, with little male oversight. They communicated with each other on topics of genuine interest to women through their own independent publications, in which they spoke out strongly for women's emancipation, education, suffrage, and entry into the professions and political systems, the feminist issues of their day. Moreover, as D. Michael Quinn and others have shown us, they believed that the endowment conferred priesthood on them, and they honored and exercised the spiritual gifts that flowed from that priesthood. I'm not suggesting that there was any golden age for Mormon women. Polygyny and the concomitant deception that surrounded it were high prices to pay for the gifts and autonomy 19th century Mormon women enjoyed. Life is far better for Mormon women today than ever before because our social and political systems outside the church have responded to women's demands for civil equality. But the relative status of women and men in the church, as compared to women and men outside the church, has never been more disparate. What I am suggesting is that because women have not had priesthood and have been excluded from all church decision-making bodies, they have been systematically stripped of nearly every spiritual gift and power they once enjoyed, while men's power and prestige has steadily soared at women's expense. This could not have happened if women had had equal power in the church from the outset. Women would not have done this to themselves. I know many women who have learned of our past and of the steady decline of women's empowerment with not a little anguish. While they are not yearning for the difficulties of pioneer life or polygyny, they recognize that we have lost something precious and irreplaceable in terms of women's spirituality, something I'm not sure we can ever reclaim. We must now find new ways to empower women spiritually, and I do not believe we can do it without priesthood. We might be able to make some modest gains by restoring the autonomy and independence of the Relief Society, but the contemporary emphasis on hierarchy and conformity, it seems to me, effectively forecloses any significant improvement for women in the foreseeable future. Women need priesthood, the right to be in charge, in order to reclaim the spiritual power that once was ours and to ensure that spiritual power will never again be lost. In response to women's demands, church leaders have in recent years made some concessions. They have agreed to let us pray in sacrament meeting. They began allowing women married to non-member or non-worthy men to receive their temple endowments. They slightly softened the sexism in the temple endowment. They denounced in the most uncertain terms men's abusive behavior toward their wives and children. They brought to bear the church's considerable power to help divorced women collect child support payments by denying temple recommends to men who fail to pay. Recently, they have assured us that they are teaching local leaders to listen to women and to take their views and concerns seriously. These are important developments that improve women's lives. What we must all understand, however, for church leaders surely understand it, is that as long as men have the exclusive power to say what spiritual roles women may or may not fill, they will also have the power to take away any concessions they might give. If the listener or reader gets one thing out of this paper, it is this. Women need priesthood because only priesthood bearers have the power to make decisions for the church and therefore for women. As long as men alone have that power, they will make decisions that harm women spiritually and temporally. How do I know that? From the lessons of history. For those who suggest that we have a benevolent patriarchy, I offer you our 160-year history of systematic repression of women's spiritual gifts to say that our patriarchy is not benevolent toward women's spirituality. It has repressed all forms of power for women, even forms that greatly benefited the church and its individual members, such as women's spiritual gifts of healing and blessing. This repression has been arbitrary and capricious without the slightest reasonable basis for it, and has harmed us all by depriving us of the gifts women have offered and would continue to freely offer to all. For those who think the solution to women's problems in the church lies in using moral suasion and recourse to Section 121 of the Doctrine and Covenants to sweet-talk our male leaders into being kinder and gentler to women, I offer you the same sorry history of repression. If 160 years of male rule has served to disenfranchise women to today's low ebb, what possible basis do you have for hoping that the next 160 years will bring us anything better? We may succeed in convincing the current powers that be to be nicer to women, to give us more autonomy, to recognize and give institutional validation to our spirituality, to stop defining our roles so narrowly, to take seriously our concerns and our problems, and to value our ideas and our gifts and our talents and our contributions. But even if we do this, our history stands as a stark and sobering reminder that what the existing power structure giveth, it also hath the power to take away. God did not withdraw the spiritual gifts of healing and blessing from women. When the men in power told women they could no longer exercise those gifts, it was not because women no longer had sufficient connection to God's grace to perform the rites they once performed. It was the men in power, not God, who brought an end to the exercise of gifts and powers that God still bestowed. To those women who think we should not opt into the power structure to be co-opted by it, I offer you, too, 160 years of repressive history toward women. Our patriarchy has effectively deprived women in the church of any collective means of defining our own spirituality within the confines and constraints of the institutional church. There is no public forum in which women can share our spiritual gifts and affirm our own and each other's. Relief Society is a forum for speaking the party line, not a place for defining and refining women's spirituality. It is a place to pledge allegiance to the existing male-dominated power structure, to confirm and nurture our spiritual dependence upon it. I am well aware that individuals and small groups of Mormon women hold retreats, bless each other and their children, seek to understand what is divine about femaleness, and in a myriad of other ways, define, assert, and develop their own sense of relation to deity quite independent of the rules and rigidity of our institutional church. But having done so, they are not allowed to speak their experience in any way or in any place that would encourage and inspire and empower the overwhelming majority of women in the church today. Like the women who have anonymously reported their healing experiences in Bettina Lindsay's article entitled Women as Healers in the Mormon Church, women are required to keep their spiritual gifts secret or risk censure. I'm under no illusion that giving women the priesthood and having them fill all church positions on an equal basis with men will solve all the church's problems, especially as those problems relate to the current tensions between the church's hierarchy and its intellectuals and liberals. But this I know. Failure to include women in the church's hierarchy will assure that women will remain at the bottom of the spiritual heap where the powers that be seem determined to keep us. Without institutionalized power in a form that cannot be taken away at the whim of the next set of rulers, women will remain disenfranchised, excluded, and spiritually at the mercy of a hierarchy that has not shown benevolence toward women's spirituality in 160 years and is not likely to start now. Solving the problem, how to integrate women into priesthood positions. There is little doubt in my mind that the day will come when women will be ordained to the priesthood. Whether that day will occur in 20 years or 120 years, I do not know, but occur it will. George Carey, Archbishop of Canterbury, recently urged the Anglican Communion to approve ordination of women, saying, quote, "We are in danger of not being heard if women are exercising leadership in every area of our society's life save the ordained priesthood," close quote. That statement is as true for Mormons as it is for Anglicans. I believe church leaders would be wise to begin taking an active leadership role, as did Archbishop Canterbury, in paving the way for a smooth transition toward the spiritual empowerment of women, a transition that must surely come to pass. How could they do this? Several ways. Church publications and curriculum materials should begin to feature articles on Mormon women's spiritual history to teach church members about women's rich spiritual legacy. This legacy is well documented and inspiring to men and women alike, and it is self-serving and even dishonest for church leaders to withhold it from the general membership or to distort or minimize it as they have sometimes done. Church leaders should begin to integrate women into all positions for which priesthood is not an actual requirement, and those, I submit, are few and far between. They should inform the membership of large of scriptural precedents for women's empowerment: Huldah the prophetess, Phoebe the deacon, Junia the apostle, and should stop minimizing these women's spiritual accomplishments and explaining them away. I'm going to digress just briefly on this, because last Saturday, when I was watching General Conference, I saw an example of church leaders explaining away women's spirituality. I have an extended footnote here citing examples of the way the church explains away women's spirituality, including things like we've got Deborah the prophetess in the Old Testament, and the New Bible Dictionary describes Deborah as a famous woman who judged Israel, omitting the fact that the Old Testament describes her as a prophetess. And Huldah, you might recall, prophesied to the king, to King Josiah, and her prophecies were preceded by "Thus saith the Lord," and they proved true, and were very influential. And the New Bible Dictionary entirely omits Huldah, and the omission was not accidental, and that fact is shown by the fact that the old Cambridge Bible Dictionary, on which the new one was roughly based, did include her as a prophetess. But what I want to tell you about was last Saturday, when I was watching General Conference, Boyd K. Packer was speaking, and he was talking about the temple, building of the Salt Lake Temple in connection with the centennial. And he talked about building temples in Nauvoo, and he said that some people in the, well, he was sort of, basically what he was doing is he was responding to Michael Quinn's article in the new book, Women and Authority. And for those of you who don't know about it, Quinn has an article in that book which argues that Mormon women have had the priesthood since 1843. And he shows how initially Mormon women and men too believed that the endowment conferred, the endowment and or second anointings conferred a kind of priesthood upon women. And women, in exercising these spiritual gifts that we've now all become familiar with, were responding to this bestowal of priesthood through the endowment. At the conference last Saturday, when Boyd K. Packer was speaking, he said some people in the church now are teaching that that priesthood is some kind of free-floating authority that is had by anyone who's been through the endowment. And then he refutes that idea and says that priesthood is only conferred by ordination. And so in this one statement, he has, without saying a word about women, has effectively said the endowment does not empower women. He's refuted this notion that I think Quinn has quite thoroughly documented. Obviously, when he said some persons are teaching that priesthood is bestowed somehow through the endowment, he was not talking about men, because the men who receive the endowment already have priesthood. He was talking about women. And refuting this as a source of spiritual empowerment for women. Continuing on, rather than explaining away women's spiritual powers, church leaders should embrace the historical research, Michael Quinn's and others, I wrote this before conference, showing that women have already been given priesthood, and they should encourage and allow that women's priesthood, whatever it may be, to be experienced and expressed and exercised to the fullest extent that God allows. If they would do this, we could have a relatively smooth transition into empowerment of women as church members grow accustomed to and learn to love and cherish women's accomplishments and faith and women's contributions to the welfare of the body of the church. I'm gonna wind up here. I think that once we have women in power, that's not necessarily going to mean that everything's going to get better all of a sudden. I think that some women might sort of try to outpope the Pope, and we'll still have hierarchical people in power. But I hope that because women have a different life experience, they will be less hierarchical than the men have been. And Deborah Tannen, in her best-selling book, You Just Don't Understand, observes that there are some important differences in the way men and women communicate. She says that for most women, the language of conversation is primarily a language of rapport, a way of establishing connections and negotiating relationships. For most men, talk is primarily a means to preserve independence and negotiate and maintain status in a hierarchical social order. And I think that if communication style is reflective of leadership style, then I find this to be another reason why we need to have women in power in the church, filling all positions of church leadership. Women need the priesthood to empower them spiritually and to give institutional validity to that spiritual empowerment. Equally important, the church needs women to have priesthood to bring into church leadership councils the talents and gifts that women have and that the church needs. It is time to take the path that leads to empowerment for all worthy Latter-day Saints, for all are alike unto God. The sooner we learn that lesson, the better off we will all be.
Hello. I'm used to talking fast in the last few minutes of anything, so if you'll listen fast, we'll get to the question part. I know it's important to save time for questions. I'm thrilled that Nadine wrote this paper. She's done a beautiful job of summarizing the major arguments against women having the priesthood and then arguing against them. In some places, I think the arguments could be tightened or strengthened, and this has been the focus of my preparation for a response. And I'll follow the same format as her paper and hopefully talk quickly. An argument on women are inferior. I think we need to point out that this is a problem in our society at large, not just within the church. And in a book, Anne Wilson Schaff, Woman's Reality, I found a nice paragraph. Male therapists and men in general have difficulty. I need this taller. Oh, well. Have difficulty understanding what it means to be born with the birthright of innate inferiority. Men, of course, do struggle with feelings of inferiority and low self-esteem, but their feelings are because of an inability to be always superior. They cannot understand how deeply the... They cannot understand how deeply the feelings of innate inferiority penetrate our being and how ever-present they are. Regardless of how confident or competent a woman is, she struggles with this given in life. In case I don't have time later, I want to point out that that's another important reason I think Nadine misses about why it's important to have women in leadership positions, not just for the decision-making, but for the counseling aspect. It would be much easier for a woman with problems to go to a female bishop or a female bishopric member with concerns than to always have to approach a male with possible female problems. Anyway, so that's another digression there. The priesthood, Nadine defines as being the right to rule. It's also serves as a role of a club or a fraternity where there are insiders and outsiders. There's a cohesiveness of those who belong. There's direction to the activities, and there are rules and express standards of conduct. These can be positive things. I also think that the positive aspects of these things would not be diluted by including women in the circles. They've been included in fraternities and college campuses, and I think that they could also be included in the priesthood. The argument about women are inferior, I agree with Nadine that it should not be an issue, but I also agree that it is an issue. You hear people, when there's a boy born into a family, oh, he finally got his boy. I've heard so many people hoping for their first child to be a son that you can't go on and say that it doesn't exist. As an athlete playing a lot of games at stake centers, I've got a couple athletes nodding, yeah. Women have to fight for the chance to use the court. When men come out of meetings, they walk across courts, and this includes stake championships, regional championships, all kinds of things. They walk out of stake meetings and walk across the court as if the women do not exist. When women are playing basketball games, if you're at one end of the court and there's a fast break down to the other end, it can get dangerous because there are often men shooting at the other basket when women are in the middle of the game. You wouldn't see that happening during men's games. You don't see women walking across courts. You don't see women. We don't see women and children shooting at the basket when men are down at the other end. That's just something that's part of our culture. The argument about women are superior. I disagree with Nadine that she thinks that women should not. the argument that men don't compete with other men in priesthood matters, and therefore women shouldn't be expected to compete either. I think that men do compete with other men. I'm not a man, so I don't know that for a fact, and I haven't been in the priesthood circles, but my guess is that there is competition there. And I think that the fear of increased competition is a real fear, that there will be women that would also compete. So there's a disagreement there. I think one of the best arguments against the women are superior discussion came from Claudia last night. And for those of you who were not here, Claudia Harris said, oh, please don't put us on a pedestal. It's uncomfortable up there. And then she went on to explain that she had a theory, and I love this theory. It made me think all night. It's going to make me think in the future. But the idea is that we have a male heavenly role model, but we don't have, we meaning men and women, we all have a male heavenly role model, so we don't expect men to live up to that male heavenly role model. But in the absence of a female heavenly role model, we expect living women to live up to and to play that role. And I thought that was a real interesting insight. Anyway, moving on. I may skip some of my comments, but I'll give you time for yours, our questions. The Mormonism's odd couple motherhood priesthood, I agree with Nadine on these comments. I have a couple other examples. The 12-year-old boys get the priesthood. 12-year-old girls, does that, I'm wondering, there's no priesthood there. Does that suggest that we are encouraging them to enter into motherhood at this age? I hope not. No motherhood available to them. It doesn't matter how a childless woman chooses to act, chooses to behave, or chooses to live her life. She does not have access to the two things that, according to this odd couple excuse, might raise her status in the church. I think these are particularly important because they're part of the problem of women viewing themselves as less valuable. In the church, we tend to categorize mothers as more important than non-mothers. Evidence to support this statement can be found by reviewing the topics included in Relief Society manuals and other church publications. There seems to be three, I'm not saying I agree with this order, but there seem to be three groups of adults in our church, and I'll list them in possible order of importance. One is males, those who have access to the priesthood if they choose appropriate behavior. Two, mothers, those who have children and therefore motherhood. And three, childless women. These women have no priesthood, no motherhood. And also pay attention that in order to move from this third group into the second group, it requires the cooperation of and willful participation of men in order to move from childless to childbearing. It's not sufficient. It's just necessary. I do not find it surprising that motherhood priesthood excuse is not a satisfying one. It's not for me. It diminishes the importance of fatherhood, and it leaves out far too many women. Moving on. Men are beasts that need taming. I think Nadine did beautiful. I would just add the point that in arguing that greedy, lustful, proud men need the priesthood in order to tame them, Chris Conkling had to make the assumption that greedy, lustful, proud men are more important than any non-greedy or non-lustful or humble men, and more important than all women. And it is impossible for me to buy into that argument. I do not agree with the beginning of that. It's interesting, too, that in this summer's symposium, Chris Conkling made the argument about women being able to control their passions and men not being able to, but 100 years ago, Brigham Young made the argument that women are not able to control their passions. So in the same paper, we've got the opposite ends of that argument. The idea of we don't want to be co-opted is one that I'll fall into later in another... quickly, not later. Yes, it's a real one. I hear this excuse too. I teach in the community college, and I hear this excuse of women who don't want to enter into administration because they don't want to go act like those guys do. I have the good fortune of having a dean who is a woman, and I'm thrilled that she didn't feel she had to be co-opted in order to be in a leadership position. She's made a fantastic contribution to our campus and will continue to do so because she is an individual who has individual things to contribute, contributions to make. Excellent part about we need a forum for women's voices. Also, one other thing about the co-opted. Nadine's position, and I think I agree strongly with Nadine, is that it is within the church system that women would be able to make a difference if we had access to the decision-making power or to those kinds of things. Sonia Johnson took another tack, and when she was trying to make an influence, she said that it would take the rebels to make changes in the church, and it would take people willing to be radicals, willing to be kicked out, to be able to make changes. And so I think it takes people from both sides, those within and those without, helping to focus our view, helping to explain the questions. I have a concern about the description of systematic suppression of women and women's spiritual power. I think that spirituality is a very individual thing, and I'm not so sure that our spirituality as individuals has been diminished or suppressed. Here I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth, and I know it's going to sound that way, so oh well. In fact, because we've not had rigid prescriptions as to our spiritual expression through priesthood ordinances, we've had more individual opportunity for spiritual expression and growth. In saying that above, I feel as if I'm furthering the don't co-opt me excuse. I also know that there are many women who have felt individually stifled, spiritually suppressed, and alienated because of church leadership positions I'm praying to or seeking access to or definition of a mother in heaven figure or the being banned from speaking. Nadine's point that even if women have had a chance for spiritual growth, we have no forum for discussion of these experiences and for sharing of information or inspirational stories is extremely important. Our folklore of spiritual giants in the church tends to be stories of by men and about men. Even our Relief Society manuals are full of comments from men about stories about men. During the last year, Relief Society groups all around the world performed community service projects. I had the opportunity to hear a sister in the Relief Society General Presidency speak about the wonderful stories that are pouring into Salt Lake City, about spiritual strength and community service that have been and are coming in. She was saying that they're trying to figure out a way of sharing the stories. Those of us there said, put them in the Relief Society manuals. We'd love to hear stories written by women about women's experiences. And she hesitated. Well, we couldn't do that. And the reason we can't do that, and this is what's disheartening to me, is because with the church getting ready to jump into countries such as China and India, we're going to be paring down what we're able to give to people, and that will be essentially the scriptures, which are a male voice. And we won't be doing a lot of revision of the Relief Society manuals. We've got those that we'll be rotating through. And so it's kind of too late to get those women's voices in. That concerns me. We need a forum. Women's voices do need to be heard. Stories do need to be told. We need to inspiring women to look up to and to model our lives after. And as when I say we, I don't mean just women. Men need those role models too. Men need to see women's faces at the front of the pulpits. Men need to see women as capable individuals. Men need to see men and women achieving and being successful. Women need to see that also. So it's not just the women that need this. Men also do. I'm getting close. There are...
this is impossible.
There are two arguments that Nadine makes that, in my opinion, lack proper supportive evidence. I'll just mention those, and then maybe by the time it gets in print, this will be stronger, because I think it's a good paper. I feel that statements made are too strong without further data or better evidence. First, the relative status of women and men in the church as compared to women and men outside of the church is worse than it's ever been, and that's the first one I'm concerned about. And second, men's power and prestige has soared at the expense of women. Although I understand the argument, I still want more data to back it up. I attribute a lot of who I am today to the experiences I had speaking in sacrament meetings as a youth speaker frequently at church and in positions of leadership in the young women's programs. My daughters have been able to give talks and prayers at young ages in primary to groups of people of a variety of ages. The opportunities inside the church are in many ways better than those outside the church for women, I think, in leadership position. That's been my personal experience. I know others would disagree. Even in early days of the church, not all women enjoyed the power and position of the elite few. And that's where I'm concerned about the argument that has changed so drastically. There were women that had power and authority in the early days of the church, but not all women had that. And there were women that, because of polygamy, had the chance to go off and get educations, but not all women in polygamy had that. It very much depended on the financial situations, as it continues to do. With that said, there are times that I felt devalued as a woman growing up in the church. Examples from my personal experience was growing up near the beach in L.A., boys had Hawaii trips every year for volleyball teams. They got to play basketball and softball, too. The girls had volleyball and softball. We didn't get people who knew anything about the sports to help us. We just kind of got on the field and were given the equipment. I remember asking as a junior in high school, can we get a basketball team? I'd love to play basketball. That would be really neat. And I was told women in the church don't play basketball by my Bishop Rick member. Imagine my surprise when I got to BYU and found out lots of people, women even, played basketball. I don't think I was worried... I don't think I was worried too much about women getting the priesthood or worried about helping to keep the voice going until I watched my daughter at age 8 get baptized, and the next day at church, I was thrilled with this baptism experience. She was just so proud. Next day at church, the nice young 12-year-old boy is having his first day passing the sacrament. And it hit home to me that the next opportunity my daughter would have of progressing through another ordinance would be temple marriage. And that wouldn't it be neat if 4 years down the road she also had that chance to stand there and be proud and pass the sacrament and live worthily and get those frequent reminders of the reasons we exist. Okay, the other major concern for the paper is that, and she's already pointed out, is that just because we give women access to ruling bodies doesn't mean that we'll necessarily make it a better place. I do think that the institution itself needs some fixing and that we tend to promote people who are part of the party line and who are part of repeating that power structure. I think the same thing would happen with women. We right now have a lot of men that don't have access to those power centers. Even though they have the priesthood, they do not have a voice either. And I think that their voices would be valuable in those ruling classes. I think the women's voices would be valuable. Most important, I want to say that that I think that women need to get the priesthood, need to get it soon. I agree with Nadine, it will happen eventually. We need to do it because it's the right thing to do. We need to do it because we'll all benefit from it, and the church will be a stronger, better place. There's a whole bunch more I could say, but I will quit. I want to end with Nadine's comment. I think this is one of the strongest arguments of the paper. Excluding women through the priesthood is not benevolent. It harms women by perpetrating women's subordination to men. It harms men by teaching them that they have the right to dominate other human beings. It harms the church by depriving it of women's contributions. I'm going to end there. And the other reason I'm excited to be part of the group, and thank you for listening to me for a few more minutes, seconds, is I think only when the priesthood leaders ask questions does a revelation come. So if we can keep this question alive in the minds of our leaders, if we can make them realize that it's an important issue to ask about, perhaps the revelation that we're hoping for will come at an earlier time, in a time when we might all enjoy. Anyway, that's a major reason that I'm happy to be here. I want to keep the discussion alive. Thank you, Nadine, for doing that. Okay.